the killing of innocent people based on a twisted ideology is an attack not just on France, not just on Turkey, but it's an attack on the civilized world.
713, the entire nation of Syria is about the size of the greater New York City area, and the population is dropping every day. And I think we're all clear that this is the epicenter of all the pain and agony that ISIS has created and continues to create. The person who knows more about this than anybody I know is our friend Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institute. And we always turn to you at times like this, Michael, to make us understand these issues better. There's no pressure there, is there?
Well, good morning to you. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you being on again. Let's go in reverse order here before we get to the root cause. What danger are we under in the near and immediate, or the immediate and the near future?
Well, there's a good debate about this. And so the bottom line is, you know, we're not sure because we realize that some of these attacks take a certain amount of luck. And it's actually, in the end, a number of individuals who do them. It's not, you know, broad forces of jihadism or whatever. I mean, those broad forces contribute, but it's ultimately four planes that are hijacked on 9/11 in the United States, or 7 or 8 or 10 or 20 people in Belgium and France who do what they did Friday. And so it's sort of statistical. It's, you know, it's chance, as well as being something you can try to assess. Mike Morrell was the deputy CIA director. Over the weekend, he was saying on national radio and television that he thought it was inevitable that we'd have some kind of an attack in the United States. By contrast, my former colleague and good friend Dan Benjamin has an op-ed in today's New York Times. He used to be the coordinator for counterterrorism at the State Department. He pointed out how much better our homeland security and our intelligence operations are than those of our European friends. And, of course, we're much further away from the epicenter in Syria or Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan. Bottom line, it's less likely to happen here, I believe, than in Europe again in the
sure.
future. But I would never try to make a sweeping prognostication. And I think we do have to be braced for the possibility of an attack that hopefully would never be on the scale of what we just witnessed in Paris. But it can't be ruled out.
Is it possible we have too much intelligence? And by that, I mean there are so many leads to chase, somebody could slip through the cracks?
Well, yes. There's just too much to track. And this has to be kept in mind anytime we have these debates over privacy. You know, and frankly, I believe the debate over privacy is important, but I actually think we've overcorrected.
Oh, completely agree.
Yeah. Made it harder for the intelligence world to keep, you know, records that it might need to search for needles in the haystack, so to speak. And once I start hearing of abuses of American citizens being prosecuted or persecuted unrighteously based on some kind of intelligence abuse, then I'll be more worried. And in fact, I would support strengthening safeguards. So if anybody ever does that based on this kind of information, that they are punished severely and promptly within the intelligence community. But I haven't seen any abuses of that
totally
type
agree.
Since 9/11. So I think we're going to have to help our intelligence communities continue to develop better tools to find these needles in the haystack.
Quick traffic update here, and then I'm going to ask Michael O'Hanlon about Syria, about Russia's partnership, if there is one with us, and where we go from here. Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institute, one of my favorite guests, is on the phone. Michael, we seem to repeat the same mistakes over and over again, and it's not because we're not decent people. We are trying to do the right thing, but in any big problem, there are immediate solutions and solutions that maybe happen down the road. Don't we at this point have to give up on the idea of a united Syria?
Well, yes, I think so, although I don't think we should break it up or see it broken up into individual states. If you do that, you probably cause more problems than you solve. For example, the Kurds, if they tried to break off into an independent state, Turkey would be livid, and any cooperation we could establish with Turkey, I think, would be foregone. So I think what you need is a very loose confederation of different smaller autonomous zones, maybe a half dozen of them. And I think that's the only realistic way. The other point I would make is that once there is a peace deal, and it's not going to happen as soon as Secretary Kerry would like, and even though I'm a big fan of his overall, I don't think he's on the right track with this process. He just continued in Vienna over the weekend. But even once we get to a deal, you know, beyond President Obama and Secretary Kerry's tenure, I think, someone's going to have to enforce it. Someone's going to have to be the army on the ground or the police force on the ground. We're going to need some kind of a UN or NATO-led peacekeeping force. And I'm anticipating that force is going to have quite a difficult job. And if you really try to piece Humpty Dumpty back together and have people live together in all the different communities where they used to, I think it becomes just an overly difficult mission that starts to resemble almost the occupations of Iraq and Syria. So you got to try to simplify it. And the way you do that, I believe, is to have these confederal zones or these autonomous zones, which essentially govern and police themselves. And the peacekeeping force would then just be sort of along the lines between them and in the central cities, a few of which will probably remain interethnic and intermixed. So looking down the road, I think a confederation just works a lot better for a lot of reasons.
Assad has to go, right?
Yes, but with this confederation model, you could have him retreat to the so-called Alawite sector, the, you know, the group he's from, and the group the Russians are trying to protect. And so there could be a compromise, which I think we'll probably need. So he would no longer have any power over Sunnis or, you know, Kurdish population, Christian population even would hopefully not have to deal with him. But he could still be either resident or even in some kind of a political office in his Alawite sector of the country. That, to me, is the natural compromise with Russia.
My idealistic view of the world is that we shouldn't have to talk about politics, but politics is intermingled, of course, in all of this. And Putin did a nice job of boxing President Obama into a corner and even offered to partner with the United States in the early hours after Friday night. What does a partnership look like? And since he wants Assad and since Russia needs Syria, and wants their naval base left alone and needs Syria's money for their weapons and things of that nature, how does Obama compromise with Putin, and how do they get beyond the fact that they seem to hate each other?
Well, they don't get beyond that latter fact. So they're just going to have to you know, be professionals and recognize their country's interests and necessitate this. And I think that's what President Obama is doing. I don't think he's had any regard for Putin for 4 or 5 years, at least. Mm-hmm. But he knows he can't just ignore him. On the issue of how we really cooperate with Russia, you know, I don't take anything Putin says at face value. And I'm sure no one else in your listening area does either. And I think that realistically, you know, we're going to have to assume that he's doing things differently from what he says or what he declares he wants. And he said, for example, he came in to fight ISIL. But no, he came in to prop up President Assad, his ally. So that's why I think we have to have this kind of a model of confederation, which allows Russia to protect its core interests, that Navy base on the Mediterranean, and so forth. But Russia is not right now going to pressure President Assad to step down. And if we think they are, I think we're deluding ourselves. And so Russia is not going to compromise on that point. They would say that Assad is still the lesser of the evils here. And if they pressure him to step down, it's not clear what will follow him. And so they feel pretty strongly about this. I don't think we're going to compromise very effectively on that point.
You know, there's many people listening who are frustrated because they don't understand how we could take what amounts to a small city of really bad guys and not simply wipe them off the face of the earth. The obvious problem with that is they have intermingled themselves amongst a lot of civilians, and 99% of the people in the areas that ISIS occupies would prefer not to die because they happen to be where ISIS is and they can't get out. So how do we make those two things work together when we've seen such slow training for forces in Iraq to defend themselves? And how good are the moderate forces in Syria to be able to pick it up and go if we give them more ammo?
They're not good enough. They're not big enough. The only forces in Syria that are good enough are the Kurds, and they're not going to go too far beyond their traditional Kurdish zones. So we're going to have to work with Arabs more effectively than we have, and to me that means putting a lot of American trainers on the ground. When I say a lot, I mean hundreds, maybe a couple thousand, and starting, obviously, in the safest places. But I think we're going to have to get beyond the delusion that we can do this all from other countries or with the 30 or 40 people that President Obama has just announced he's willing to send into Syria. It's going to take hundreds. The training is going to have to happen on the ground inside of Syria at more of an industrial scale. And then I think we'll be in a better position, at least to carve out some relatively more secure areas. We can start helping provide humanitarian relief. You know, we can break the problem down into more manageable bite-sized pieces.
And where do you rank Belgium in all of this now?
Well, yeah, I mean, good question. We've really learned a lot. I mean, obviously, European intelligence agencies knew about some of the more difficult neighborhoods in Brussels, and I think the rest of the world is finding out the hard way. Belgium is going to need, you know, what can you say? It almost has to treat these areas like the same kinds of zones that we've faced in Iraq and Afghanistan, where you have to build up an integrated strategy. You don't go in with tanks, obviously, but you build up an integrated strategy to patrol the streets more effectively, to reach out with more economic opportunity. If you don't do these things, especially with all the refugees flooding in and probably a lot of them going to these more difficult neighborhoods in Brussels, the problem is just going to get worse.
Michael O'Hanlon's new book, The Future of Land Warfare, talks about the fact that you can't do it by just flying over it. You can't do it by just talking about it. And if you get deeply into the book, you'll see that it's very readable, very understandable, and brings a lot of common sense into a very difficult problem. Brookings.edu has more on the future of land warfare, but we can get it wherever books are sold, can't we?
That's right. Again, very kind of you to plug it. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate you being on. We'll talk again soon. Thank you, Michael.
That sounds good. Thank you.
Michael O'Hanlon from the Brookings Institute, Brookings.edu.